From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we bring you the seventh in a series of conversations with Professor Luciana Bone about the construction of the Soviet state and economy from the 1917 revolution forward. Thus far, we've looked at the condition of the state and the economy from November of 1917 through the period known as war communism implemented by Lenin and the Soviet government immediately after the revolution, to the new economic policy or new economic program known as NEP, to the establishment of collective agriculture and rapid industrialization. Today we look at the period from 1929 to 1932. So Luciana, we'll pick up where we left off last time and take a close look at the period from 1929 to 1932, which is a period of tremendous success, as God's plan.
Yes. So what was the God's plan? The God's plan. It was the agency, it was the agency responsible for central economic planning in the Soviet Union until 1991. It created and administered a series of five-year plans governing the Soviet economy according to the objective declared by the Communist Party. So, starting with the 1928 plan, industrial production grew at an annual average of 11%. From 1928 to 1940, the industrial sector grew from 28% to 45% of the economy. Between 1928 and 1937, the share of just heavy manufacturing output of total manufacturing output grew from 31% to 63%. That's just to give you a frame of where, you know, of where we're going.
Mm-hmm.
So this leap of progress was made possible through the collectivization of agriculture, which funded what I call the Soviet Industrial Revolution.
Right.
You know, the full-blown Soviet Industrial Revolution. So with the 1928 plan, Stalin accepted and completed Lenin's plan of 1921 of establishing state-owned cooperative farming. So, you know, Lenin actually had this in mind, but we will remember that between 1921 and 1928, we had the NEP plan. So the NEP plan allowed for private property, essentially. Now, the collectivization of farms in 1928 consisted of adding production cooperatives to the already existing state-owned marketing and supply cooperatives that had been organized in the decade of the 1920s. So Lenin had made it possible to develop marketing and supply cooperatives, but the production was still in the hands of what we call the peasant class. Now, so collective farms are a form of cooperatives, but the collective farms are so-called because they were tasked with production. So this is what collectivization meant.
And they were tasked. They were tasked by the state. In other words, the state was looking at the entire economy and saying, "Okay, yeah, we need this much agricultural product here, there, whatever." And they would say, "Here's some quotas. This is what we need you to do."
Yeah, I mean, that's right. The party would set the objectives. The Goss plan would then plan around it. But you're right. It was a matter of extending, improving the actual Lenin plan. I say this because Stalin is accused of deviating from from Lenin, and I see in my research that he continued Lenin's. He was Lenin's student, really. Something that occurred to me in response to your comment is that why did Lenin was able to form only market and supply cooperatives? Because, of course, the land belonged to the kulaks, to the rich peasants, and they were the producers. You see, they had the means of production under NEP. So now this is what's going to happen. Collectivization means expanding Lenin's cooperative farm project. No, and so collective farms, the collectivization was the result of the development of the marketing and supply cooperatives, which had started by Lenin, been started by Lenin in 1921. Do I get that clear there?
Yes, I get it. Yep.
Yeah. Good. Okay. So by 1927, some state-owned production cooperatives, but they were typically set up on lands where there were no peasants. Again, you see the difference, the problem of having vast tracts of land in the hands of the kulaks. They had to have, the Soviet government had to establish production farms in lands that were not being cultivated and that had no peasant presence. Okay. So large-scale production itself was in the hands of the peasant class, and this class comprised, as we've mentioned before, rich, middling rich, and poor peasants. The rich peasants, the kulaks, owned vast lands, we went into this in the last program, and employed and exploited the poor peasants. So you had a capitalist situation within the Russian Revolution or the Bolshevik Revolution. Now, the kulaks, I'm just going to summarize briefly what we already talked about last time. But the kulaks, I mean, the problem was that they could dictate prices to the state and manipulate supply by hoarding, for example, which was a common practice during the NEP years. So, in fact, the situation of exploitation by the kulaks was the result of the NEP policy that restored private property in the attempt to relieve scarcity, which, you know, food scarcity. Now, in 1927 and 28, Stalin's government proposed not only to relieve scarcity, but to engineer abundance. Now, one thing that we need to emphasize here is that collectivization was not achieved by force, as is related by anti-communist accounts, not at any rate by forcing the middle and poor peasants into collective production. Stalin was very clear about this. He said to the Central Committee in 1927-28, we can and should assist the small and middle individual peasant farms. We should help them to increase their crop yields, and we should draw them into the channel of cooperative organization. We cannot and should not lend any support to the individual large kulaks farms. Mm-hmm. Now, whatever force was applied was legal, and it was the expropriation of the expropriators, the lands of the kulaks. They were seized, and the law provided for the kulaks to be separated from their property, removed to areas far away in Siberia, allowed to farm there if they chose, but prohibited from returning for 5 years. And if they return, were never allowed to practice agriculture again.
Right.
So apart from removing the class enemy, and the one that would obstruct the progress of the revolution, there was very little force and very little resistance.
Right.
In fact, Stalin criticized those local organizers, the zealots and party envoys who rushed to come above revolutionary ideas on the peasants, instead of allowing their class allegiance to socialism to evolve as a result of improved material conditions. So, for example, the condition of women improved on collective farms because they were now moving from an agricultural society into eventually industrial. So we know that peasant cultures anywhere are historically patriarchal. The woman belongs first to the father and then to the husband, but on collective farms, women were guaranteed a salary. Women became self-determined, the bosses of their own course of life, whom they should marry, where they should live.
Right.
So that was one form of liberalization brought about by the change. I'll have some more to say. Now, I just want to finish this part about agriculture and get into the industrial development.
Yeah.
So the peasants were not forcibly stripped of their traditions. A large part of that was a religious tradition. So Stalin mocked those party cadres who went into villages and the first thing they did was strip the bells from the churches. And he commented tauntingly, "Removing bells from churches. How revolutionary," he said. So this is the man that is depicted in the West with terror on churches, etc.
Yeah. Right.
So there are two myths that are immediately, that if you know, two myths in the West that claim that in the main the peasants resisted collectivization because it was a second serfdom.
Right.
And this is false. Those who make the claim make no distinction between rich kulaks and poor peasants.
Yep.
They apply no class analysis. They say, the peasants were forcibly... You see what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, the imagery that's called up here is that you have these peasants who were serfs, you know, working under the old feudal system, and then for a minute they win their freedom, and then the state comes in and takes the place of the old lord of the manor and reimposes feudalism on them, only now the money goes to Moscow, to the state, to Gosplan, instead of to the czar. That's basically it. That's the imagery.
Go ahead.
No, that's it. That's the imagery, and it's totally false. Right.
I mean, it's just, and then the second myth is that Stalin, quotation marks, because there's only one person leading the state, and that's this Stalin in quotation marks,
and
they mean the Soviet leadership deliberately created the famine of 1932-33, but you would think that if the state intended to kill all these, to famish all these people, you would find some document, some policy that would indicate this was the intention. And of course, none of that has ever been discovered. And I think that if it existed, we shall eliminate the peasants. My God, what a ridiculous notion.
Yeah.
We shall eliminate all the peasants because it's never been found, and you think that the Cold War propaganda would have been able to dig this up, and that it wasn't a policy.
Of course not.
I mean, the famine had environmental causes, and that's that. What was I going to... You were going to say something?
Yeah, well, it's analogous to, like, well, the Rothschilds or the Rockefellers caused the various problems, Dust Bowl and all of that stuff in agriculture in the United States. It's, and you could actually make a stronger case for that because of the misallocation of capital from, you know, creating the infrastructure that would have, prevented some of that or whatever, and the rationalization of markets that might have helped. But you know, it's as absurd on its face as that.
Yeah, and all people have to do is just go to the archives and read and they're very, you know, Stalin's directives, reports, and this is a very sensible, concrete kind of government. I mean, it has to do some harsh. It has to. You know that the Kulaks. Okay.
Okay.
Anyway, by 1927, though, by 1927 on these land, by 1927, the gross production of grain in the existing state farms amounted to 45 million poods, with a marketable surplus of 65%. Think about it. Even, you know, by 1927, there was this enormous marketable surplus. You could see, right, the wealth there, the potential wealth for the state. Marketable. 65% could be marketed. I suppose exported, right?
Right.
So Stalin thought that given a certain amount of state support, state farms could considerably increase the production of grain. And I quote him now. He says, the organization of these state farms has already begun. He says this in, I think, 1928. Now, the task is to put the decision of the Soviet government, the decision to have state farms, into effect at all costs. I think that provided these tasks are fulfilled, within 3 or 4 years, we shall be able to obtain from the old and new state farms about 80 to 100 million poods from 45 million of grain for the market. See,
yep.
That's why agriculture made industrialization possible.
That's right.
Now, what were the results? By 1932, the five-year plan was completed in just 4 years to 93.7%. That's the total plan. Now, heavy industry alone was fulfilled in 4 years at 108%. I've talked before about one of the most important task was the mobilization of resources to industrial agriculture. And so the mobilization of these resources to industrialize agricultural society created the need of a labor force, which meant that unemployment went virtually to zero. That's another result.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in December 1932, Stalin declared to the Central Committee that the plan had been a success because the increase in the production of coal and iron would feed future economic development. Mm. Now, this is interesting. Some historians have even suggested that the first plan would have had even more success if the USSR had not had to deal with the economic crisis abroad,
right,
which was outside its control. Now, This is happening in the Soviet Union, these increases, while in the West we're having the Great Depression.
Right. You mentioned the fact that there was zero unemployment at this point in the Soviet Union.
Yep.
In 1932, unemployment, well, you saw a decline in the economy of more than 50% and decrease in GDP, almost 50% over the two-year period. But that unemployment became, the norm. people lost their jobs by the millions in the United States in the early 30s.
Yeah. Glad you pointed that. Yeah, I know. It's amazing. But there's another reason why the five-year plan was slowed down, and that's, I seldom hear this said, and that was the refusal to conclude, the refusal to conclude pacts of non-aggression
right.
on the part of neighboring countries.
Right.
So the plan was slowed down by this refusal
right.
to,
Yeah, the objective condition there is that we have to set aside a larger defense expenditure because, you know, the conditions around us are a little murky.
Yeah, they don't want to make pacts with us, so they're actually not, you know, whatever they're planning. And in the Far East, the Japanese occupied China's Manchuria in 1931, and all of this predicted war and forced the Soviet Union to convert some factories to the production of munitions to bridge the gap of defense. You know?
Yep.
So, now, what also happened is that the mobilization of resources by state planning increased the nation's industrial base. For example, the production of cast iron, which is necessary for the development of an industrial infrastructure,
right.
grew from 3.3 million to 10 million tons per year.
Right. Coal,
the product that fueled modern economies, grew from 35.4 million to 75 million tons.
More than doubled.
The production of iron ore rose from 5.7 million to 19 million tons.
Four times almost, yep.
Yeah. So industrial complexes such as Magnitogorsk, Kuznetsk, car factories in Moscow and Gorky, industry of heavy machinery of the Urals and Kramatorsk, tractors, factories of Kharkov, Stalingrad, and Chelyabinsk were already built or under construction in 4 years.
Right.
So the industrial policies of Stalin improved widely also the quality of life for the majority of the population.
Mm-hmm.
Employment, for example, rose greatly from 3.9 million in 1923 to 6.4 million in 4 million in 1932. For 1937, the number grew again to about 7.9 million, and in 1940 it was 8.3 million.
Mm.
Now, between 1926 in 1930, the urban population increased to 30 million units. Unemployment had been a problem under the Tsar and even under the NEP, but disappeared under this period and ever after, I think.
Yeah.
The car factories in Moscow and Gorky were producing cars that the public could use. The expansion of heavy industry and steel production made it possible to build a large number of cars. The production of trucks and cars, for example, reached 200,000 units in 1931. I remember what the Soviet Union, or rather Russia, was in 1921.
Right.
So education, since workers in industry, skilled workers, needed education, so the number of schools increased. In 1927, 7.9 million students attended 118,558 schools. Now, these numbers rose from 7 million to 9.7 million by 1933, and the schools rose to 166. I can't say numbers. 166,275. So about 40,000 school added in 4 years.
Wow. 10,000 schools a year or 1,000 a month, roughly. Wow.
Amazing. Plus specialized schools, 566 institutions were built, and 900 departments of, you know, specialized studies. Operative by 1933. Now, the Soviet population benefited from a certain degree of social liberalization. Women, for example, the first historical oppression, the second one, there are three that they tackled.
Right. And that was a very important one that dealt with a majority of the population, actually.
Yeah. So they received, women received an equal education, equal rights to work. They accelerated and improved their lives, condition, and that of their families. And also, there was advancement of health. This period saw the advancement of health, which increased the life expectancy of the typical citizen and their quality of life.
Yep.
The policies of Stalin ensured universal access to education and health care, allowing this generation to be the first not to fear typhus, cholera, and malaria. The number of cases for these diseases dropped to record lows, increasing the life expectancy of decades. This sounds like Cuba, you know?
Yes, exactly.
it sounds like, but, you know, they don't have freedom of speech, and it's a reign of terror, but...
Right. But people aren't dying of cholera or starvation. They're living indoors. They're getting an education, health care, and all of that. Yeah, it's amazing. I know.
Yeah, it's amazing. Who are these people? Did they never suffer hunger? Who are these people who say, poof, what hunger, illness? No, what we need is freedom of speech and freedom of whatever.
Right.
Freedom, abstract freedoms.
Yeah.
But anyway, Soviet women in the Stalin period were the first generation of women able to give birth safely in hospitals with access to prenatal care. You know, Don, that in my village of 300 people, I was the first baby born in the hospital because my parents were progressive.
Wow. How long ago was this? How long ago was this? And where?
What?
I mean, and where? Where is this?
Where I was born.
Yeah.
Oh, the painful. It's now Croatia. It was Yugoslavia.
Right.
Before that, it was occupied by fascist Italy, and before that, it was Austria.
Mm.
How's that?
Wow.
It's a village in Middle Europe,
yeah,
you know?
Very volatile borders, yes.
East of Trieste. Trieste is about... Ooh, about 70 miles from Venice.
Right.
So it's kind of where... Oh, I'll give you a better point of guidance. It's where the Iron Curtain ended in the south. It started in Stettin. Is it Gdansk? I don't know.
Mm.
Started in Stettin in Poland.
Right.
And it ended on... in Trieste.
Ah.
So I was right on the limit, on the liminal.
Of the Iron Curtain. And we're going to leave it there and come back picking up around 1932 next week. And Luciana, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.